Chapter 18. Mrs. Hawthorne, Edinburgh. Everywhere I turn, Clarissa is there, judging. I'm suffocating under her glare, and the house has the dark, heavy air of a mausoleum. Things have to change. But how? With a resounding thud, he closes the front door, and we stroll hand in hand down the driveway. At least she can't follow us there. Will they like me? I ask nervously. He squeezes my hand. They'll love you. How could they not? I hope he's right. Meeting his friends for the first time is pivotal. Clarissa hasn't been dead for long, and there's me. His new... I stumble over a description. New what? Girlfriend is too young and makes us sound like teenagers. Partner is too formal, like a law firm. I'll let him decide what's right. Tell me about them again, Charles.
Robert worked in finance, and his wife, Elizabeth, was a librarian. But they're retired now, and spend most of their time travelling in Europe. They're nice people. You'll be fine. Just be yourself.
Did Clarissa like them? He pauses, and in front of a dry stone dike we come to a halt. The wall borders the canal that runs down into Leith. I should walk it one day. Amble into town. Squeals of delight rise towards us as children in bright yellow wellies skim stones across the surface of the water. Their parents look on, and a dog braver than Jack paddles beside them.
Clarissa didn't really like anyone, Charles says.
All that is absent in Charles's house is abundant at his friend's home. The walls of the hallway are scattered with art, small pencil drawings amidst large, bright abstracts and grand pieces of tapestry. Three archways branch off the tiled floor. To the right is a living room, with sprawling cream sofas draped with green tartan throws. An open fire sparks embers of warmth, and shelves brim over with books. To the left, a large kitchen reveals a fairy-lit garden through its open doors, and my heart melts, enchanted. Chili and ginger spice the air, and Robert welcomes us into the dining room, where across the table, scattered glitter dances in low candlelight. "You have a beautiful home," I say to Robert.
"Thank you,"
he replies, and pours burgundy into wine glasses. Elizabeth, her dark hair held back with diamante clasps, stacks naan bread next to a bubbling red casserole dish. "I hope you like chickpea curry," she smiles. Charles shifts forwards in his chair, and I kick his shin under the table. "Smells delicious," I reply. "I detest chickpeas." As is often the case when old friends meet, they recount old tales, talking over each other and finishing each other's sentences. All the stories centre around Charles, and I smile at the appropriate points, an outsider looking in. Yet I hang on to every word, relishing the love they have for him, and how Charles blooms in their presence. Once we've complimented dessert, a gloriously sticky toffee pudding, Elizabeth grabs a bottle of wine and heads towards the patio doors. "Come sit with me outside while the men tidy up," she says. It's time for her to investigate my intentions. The patio is strung with delicate lights and dotted with plants in terracotta pots. There are four wicker chairs. I choose the one nearest to her, cozying up to any secrets she'll share. I'm desperate to find out who Clarissa was,
but don't want to appear obsessive. How to bring up the topic? A gold charm drapes from my wine glass. I run it through my fingers, admiring Elizabeth's artistic flair for detail. So, you're very different from Clarissa, she says. I squeeze the charm so hard that its edges cut into my hand. Oh, am I? I'm not sure, as I didn't know her at all. I lean forward and nudge her with an inquisitive girls all together type smile. Elizabeth sips her wine, and her eyes roam the garden. I don't interrupt the silence. Clarissa was a hard woman to get to know. I check Charles and Robert is still in the kitchen, then pull my chair closer. Charles doesn't talk about her, I coax. He was devastated when she died. Wouldn't see anyone, just locked himself away in the house with Jack. We were all surprised to hear about you. You've changed him, though. He seems back to his old self. While I am thankful for this, I'm more interested in Clarissa, so I push the conversation back onto her. So, what was she like? A few dry leaves pepper the table. Elizabeth stands and sweeps them into her palms. She's stalling, and there's an uncomfortable tension between us that wasn't there before. I bring my glass to my mouth to stop blurting something out. Clarissa was a ballerina, a magnificent one. A ballerina? What? How had I never known this? Charles had said she was a dancer, but a ballerina. That's a new level of threat. My hand clutches my throat. I mustn't compare this new image with my own soft flab, or I'll vomit. And although that was behind her, she was still strict with her regimens and could be quite the snob. She came from old money and had very fixed ideas. It wasn't always easy trying to be a friend to her, but Charles adored her. Does that mean he thinks I'm lazy? Elizabeth picks up her glass and puts her arm around me. Anyway, enough of all that. You're here now. She's not. Let's join the men for charades. Dispersed within clouds of laughter, Charles stutters out, "Cycling, jumping, roller coaster."
"Time's up,"
Robert cries. "Flying in a plane during turbulence? Oh my, you're hopeless, Charles," I groan. I slump down beside him, curl my feet up onto the sofa. He throws an arm around me and kisses my cheek. The public display of affection makes me glow.
"How would one know such a thing?"
he says, and we all collapse in mirth. It's wonderful to be part of such a lovely group of friends. I've lost track of mine over the years, and it's at times like this that I regret it. Robert shares another bottle of wine around, and Elizabeth suggests a game of bridge. The evening will go on, and I'm delighted. We walk the short distance back home, heady from the wine and exhilarated by the evening. It had been fabulous, such a success, and I'd loved seeing Charles mix with his friends. He's usually quite stuffy and formal, but he'd loosened up tonight. I'm so proud of him, and don't want the evening to end. "Let's play Guess That Song," I say.
"How do we do that?"
We take turns humming the intro of a song, and the other person has to guess the title. He bounces in delight, as if I've given him the stars from the sky. snapping and clicking his fingers. He sways side to side and hums. Dum-dum, chi-chi-chi, dum-dum, chi-chi-chi, dum-dum. I've no idea, Charles. He repeats it, adding a little twirl, as if that will add to my understanding. I've no clue, but he's so funny and carefree, so I join in, and we both snap and sway to the front door. And in that moment, all our ages swept away, every twist and line of our past erased. We're 18 again, and I want the moment to last forever. I give in. What's it called?
Such a heathen,
he replies. It's the great Miles Davies, a tune called Too Much.
Oh, Charles, how would I know that? It's meant to be old pop songs.
His eyes sparkle, and we giggle as he searches for his door keys.
My turn, my turn,
I say, jiggling about on the gravel. I hum The Most Beautiful Girl in the World. With Charles by my side, for the first time, the lyrics could be written about me. He turns back and glares, his eyes hard. That was my wife's song. I played it at her funeral. He pushes open the door, and a rush of bitter air releases into the warmth of the night. I stagger back from the assault, but I won't cry. Not in front of Clarissa, who watches from the painting at the foot of the stairs. Something has to change.
Chapter 19. Nicky, the beach. The train dissolves into the salt air, and I stumble trying to secure my feet in wet sand. The gatekeeper smiles and hands me a strawberry daiquiri.
Welcome back, ladies.
Mrs. Hawthorne is on her knees, sifting sand, transfixed on the greens that slip through her fingers.
Ronnie strides up, her hands clenched, always so angry.
You did the right thing leaving that loser, Nicky.
I don't know why you stayed with him so long. I'm too thirsty to respond, and I gulp down my drink. The strawberries taste like summer, but it's chilly on this beach.
He's old enough to be your father.
Why did you go with him anyway? She's really getting on my nerves. I honestly don't know who she thinks she is. I've heard her story, and she's no Snow White. In fact, she should be ashamed of herself.
I bet he wasn't even a good fuck,
she chuckles, and I can't believe the cheek of her. I slam a drink on the wooden bar. Coming from you, Ronnie, that's a laugh.
What's that supposed to mean?
I don't answer. The waves are pulling, and I want to start again. I move towards their chant, towards Blackpool, Egg Gate, and the greasy cafe.
But she tugs on my arm and demands a response.
I said, what's that supposed to mean, Nicky? Can't she see Gio hurt me? What a bitter cow with no thought for anyone else. God only knows what's made her this way. But I'm not afraid of her. I place my hands on her chest and push her out of my space. You don't even like sex, Ronnie. You just use it like money to get what you want.
I like sex, all right. But I'm not the one who was mistaken for a prostitute, hun.
I push her harder, and she lands on her ass.
You're prostituting yourself to get Graham to love you? Why would you be so desperate, Ronnie?
She leaps up and races towards me, her face screwed red in anger. But I shift to the left, and she lands flat on her stomach. The sand whooshes up around her, and she coughs and splutters. I laugh.
Ladies, have some decorum,
Mrs. Hawthorne says. Ronnie turns towards her, lips drawn, sand falling from her hair.
And you can shut up. Your Charlie boy is in love with a fucking ghost.
Mrs. Hawthorne lowers her head and picks up a handful of sand.
Charles does love me.
I throw a snarl at Ronnie. You're a nasty bitch. Oh, fuck off, Nicky. Go play sandcastles with the old bag if you're both such pals. I stick the middle finger up to her. The gatekeeper sighs.
Are you happy with Graham, Ronnie?
Ronnie nods, and I don't believe her. How could she be happy with someone who fucks around? She just doesn't want to admit it to herself or us. He turns to Mrs. Hawthorne.
And you? Are you happy with Charles?
She looks up, tears in her eyes.
Of course. He's everything I've ever wanted.
Ronnie shouts from the bar. Yeah, but are you everything he wants? Or are you just his second best? I really hate her. I mean, okay, maybe Mrs. Hawthorne is being used, but it's not our place to judge her. And anyway, she's old. The gatekeeper looks out to the sea, and all three of us watch him.
Love is like these waves lapping the shore. It rises and falls between euphoria and pain. No matter our age, our life is shared with those moments of ebb and flow.
He walks over to Mrs. Hawthorne and lifts the sand from her hand.
But is love an irresistible emotion sent to taunt, haunt and devour us? Is that what love is?
He throws the sand into the air and moves towards Ronnie, who's sitting on a barstool swinging her legs. He brushes the hair from her face and looks into her eyes.
Are the waves set to drown us or wash us free, Ronnie?
Then he's next to me, and as he takes my hand, I remember the same touch from somewhere else in my past. If I could only please it.
What once delights us soon darkens, Nicky. Is love merely a choice?
Ronnie runs over and pushes his hands off mine. Leave her alone. She made her choice. She dumped him. Now let's all go back to where we were. I was happy before all this shit started. The gatekeeper smiles.
Happy reliving the same scene over and over, Ronnie. Just stuck here, watching the waves.
Ronnie doesn't answer. And I know why. She wants more, just like we all do. She wants to move on. Mrs. Hawthorne stands, shakes her dress and takes my hand.
But you did dump him, didn't you, dear?
And I'm not sure. For just as before, I can't remember anything of my life. The gatekeeper throws out his arm, sweeping all three of us in.
Let the stories unfold.
He turns to Ronnie.
You're ready to go back.
1 minute! I shout and hold out my other hand. Ronnie runs over and her fingers find mine. I'm sorry, she whispers. And I nod and grip tight. The beach fades. Chapter 20. Ronnie, Liverpool. If Graham doesn't stop the car, I'll not be responsible for my actions. I've warned him. He finds it hilarious, but he'll soon change his mind.
Ronnie, there's nowhere to stop. We're on a motorway.
Then find a place, Graham. I'm serious. I want out of the fucking car.
Okay. Hang on. I'll turn off at the next junction.
On either side of us are bright yellow fields of rapeseed. The blaze beautifies the monotony, but their pollen assaults my nose. Graham accelerates, and the fields blur into the past. I cling to the seatbelt, not knowing what the fuck I'm doing here. A few days ago, it had seemed exciting, but I should have known. The idea came to me as we drank white wine at his kitchen table. I'd mentioned that I wanted to see Paris, and he'd surprised me with flight tickets and a box of croissants. Those moments of romance were sparse, but he's falling in love. Why else would he be so invested? As he cooked a celebratory coq au vin, I thought about the French and their idea of marriage. Their cinq à sept, as my old uni friend from France called it.
She'd glowed about her husband, his job, his successes. But when she talked about her lover, she'd glittered like a star. Was she worried her husband would find out? She'd laughed at my naivety and told me he'd a lover of his own. No one cared. Marriage was for love and commitment. Lovers were for sex and a bit of fun. I decided to find some swingers that indulged in wife swapping. Friends were too close to home, but strangers, well, I'd never meet them again. It took careful planning and a few late-night phone calls, but Kirsty and Tom appeared sane and up for it. They were around our ages and not too far away. We chatted about limits, and I pretended to be excited. But all the while I was talking my mind into being more French. It was sex. It meant nothing. When I told Graham about the arrangements, he had to sit down from the shock. A minute later, he was planning the route. The traffic slows to a halt, and Graham's shiny red Lexus adds a pop of class to the jam in front. Cars edge closer, drivers stressed because they're 10 minutes late for their dull destinations. I wish I was one of them. "I'm getting out!" I scream. Opening the door, I run over to the scruff that borders the road. There's not much coverage, and glancing over to the traffic, I imagine the passengers squirming with excitement at this sudden bit of action. Fuck them. I don't care. Squatting, I wrench up my skirt, thrust down my knickers, and a rush of hot piss splatters to the ground. I sigh in relief. A few horns toot in either applause or indignation. I flick them a finger and wink. It's best to brazen these things out. We're in the travel lodge, sitting in the bar. Apart from an old guy reading a newspaper and nursing a pint, we're the only customers in the pub. Not our usual choice of venue. We much prefer an overpriced cocktail lounge. Graham sits beside me, cool, calm, and devastatingly gorgeous, a lemonade in his hands. Mine cradle a long vodka, the crushed ice cooling my flushed skin. We're meeting them here as a safety precaution and then, if all goes well, proceeding to their home. Of course, they really mean they want to score the livestock, decide if we're good enough looking or not. Panic springs my fears wide open. What if they don't like me? How would I cope with the shame of ruining Graham's night? I pick up a cardboard coaster and peel the layers apart, an eye on the door. And in they walk. Kirsty is in her late 50s, with short auburn curled hair. She's dressed in a denim mini dress and saggy fishnet tights. A pink rumpled cardigan is wrapped tight across her drooping breasts. It's about two sizes too small, and from the fuzzy bobbling of the wool, it's not new. She's desperate, sad, and nothing like how she described herself. I'm sorry for her, but I'm fucking relieved. There's no way this will go ahead. Her partner, Tom, saunters towards me. He's young, about 30, good-looking and dressed in jeans and a crisp white shirt. His cocky grin slaps a smile onto my face. I can't look at Graham or I'll collapse into laughter. The bedroom walls are papered in floral chintz and match the curtains and duvet covers on the single bed. An ornate white dressing table holds a myriad of perfumes and trinkets. Mostly these are coloured bead necklaces and long gold chains with dangling moonstones. On the bedroom door, a nylon dressing gown and feather boa are draped around a silver hook. A ring of damp surrounds the cheap chandelier hanging from the ceiling. I sit on the bed underneath it. Is there a leak? Or has it not been painted? Maybe, if I'm lucky, the ceiling will collapse. Indistinguishable sounds rise from the floor below, and I want to tear my hand from Tom's gentle grasp, but I must keep up some semblance of the act.
Ronnie, you don't want to do this, do you?
Tom whispers.
Not really. I thought I could. But I just can't. I'm sorry. I blush. There's nothing wrong with him. If we'd met in a club, I'd have exchanged numbers. But lying here side by side is clinical and sordid. I'm repelled by the seediness of it all. He passes me a tumbler of warm vodka. My granny used to have the same glasses in a cupboard in her living room. She kept them safe for special visitors or a wee shot of sherry at Hogmanay. It's okay, he says. He moves and sits on the old shabby rug, his hands splayed behind him, helping to hold the weight of his disappointment. I'm almost free, except my thoughts still focus on the sounds below.
You're beautiful, Ronnie,
he says. But I'm not enough for Graham. What is he doing down there that makes her squeal? Why don't I make those same noises when he touches me? Is nothing special? Tom stands and combs his fingers through his hair. He's agitated.
You deserve better than this. If you were mine, I'd never share you. I'd keep you all to myself.
But what about Kirsty? You share her?
I retort.
He smiles.
Kirsty's just a mate. I've known her for years. She's a bit kinky and asked me to partner up with her so she could do this swapping thing. We aren't an item. I'm single.
So? They had lied about being partners? Does anyone ever tell the truth?
As Kirsty whimpers in ecstasy, I realise my mistake. It's me I feel sorry for, not her.
Tom hands me his business card. He's a lawyer specialising in family law. The idea of that makes me smile.
Call me Ronnie,
he says.
I'll treat you like a queen.
Weaving our goodbyes, I march to the car boot, grab a bottle of wine, then settle into the seats. After a deep slug and gargle, I turn to him. How could you? He responds with laughter, and I slap his leg.
Oh, come on. It was a bit of fun.
But she was about 60. You couldn't have fancied her.
She was nice. We'd a good time. It was exciting. Didn't you have fun too?
I didn't. It was as seedy as fuck. And I can't understand why he went through with it. She wasn't his type at all. Yeah, it was okay. But mine was better than yours. And he told me to dump your ass. Said you didn't appreciate me. Said he'd never share like you.
Graham slows down and glares.
Oh, did he? Bloody fool. You'd be bored with someone like that. I hope you told him to get lost.
And I think, would I? Would I really be bored?
Graham puts his foot down.
Let's go home and get packed. We're off to Paris in the morning. Maybe we'll get one of those caricatures done near the Sacré-Cœur. You've always fancied that.
What might the artist draw when he looks at me? What will he see? That would be so romantic, Graham.
It would, especially in Paris.
He smiles and lays his hand on my thigh. My heart soars up through the sleazy shame of the past few hours. That was just sex. It wasn't romance. It wasn't him and me. It had all been worth it. Hadn't it? Chapter 21. Nicky, Edinburgh. Mum, where's my coke? I'd left it on the coffee table, but she'll have lifted it. The 3-minute rule.
I thought you were finished.
Mum, I'm nearly 19, not 9. If I'd finished, I'd have brought it through to the kitchen.
Aye, well, we don't want rats, Nicky.
In she marches, duster across her shoulder, hoover in hand. We've just eaten lunch, and Mum cleans after every meal or snack. She bangs the hoover against the sofa and I sigh and assume the position. Sit back, feet off the carpet, legs in the air.
You can sigh, Nicky, but when I was wee, the rats used to jump on us when we were sleeping. She shudders. Huge as cats they were too.
She'll be telling me next about how Granny tore sheets of newspapers to wipe all the bums in the outside toilet. Rats wouldn't dare face you now, Mum.
She tickles the duster across my face.
I flinch back from the nasty thing. Ugh, Mum!
So, what are you going to do, hen? They're looking for staff down at the new pub. Linda said her daughter got a job there. They pay good wages. You get your dinner free too.
The thought makes me want to vomit. Mum would have a fit if I did. Her special friend, Mr. Bleach, would be out. We'd not be able to breathe through the fumes for days. I don't know, Mum.
And I really don't. It's hard being home when you're used to your own space.
Difficult reverting back to a child. Getting told to make your bed and turn the light out at midnight. Mum's house is beautiful. She works hard for every penny.
But it's like a showroom. Everything's spotlessly clean and in its right place.
By just sitting still, you are making the place untidy.
I'm going to get the bairns from school, Nicky. You want to come?
Nah, I'm going up to Granny's for a wee while.
Okay.
She puts the hoover away, then stands in front of the hall mirror, touching up her hair and refreshing her signature red lipstick.
And Nicky, that guy you ran away from, you know, you're enough on your own, don't you? That you don't need a man. I smile.
Yes, Mum. But I really liked him.
Yeah, I liked your dad too. But that's no reason to put up with men's shit. We've all been fine since he left, haven't we?
I nod. But in the beginning, when she thought we were all sleeping, I'd hear her cry every night into her pillow. My mum's too proud to deal with me knowing. She'd hate it. But she's right. We're all much happier on our own. But it doesn't mean I don't miss Dad. And it doesn't mean I don't miss Gio.
George, will you open the sack up wider? Christ, you can't do nothing right.
Oh, hush, woman. I'm doing it. Come on.
Granny and Grandad are in the back garden, digging for potatoes. I've snuck around the back and I'm giggling at their antics. Grandad is always getting shouted at for something or other. Usually it's for falling asleep during her favourite TV programme, Coronation Street.
Will you wake up, George, and stop snoring? I can't hear what Ken Barlow's saying.
Grandad would wake with a jolt, but always be back snoring 5 minutes later. Granny puts her foot on the speed, pushes deep into the ground and digs out a big clod of potatoes. When she throws them into the sack, he's looking the other way, and they scatter across his feet. He jumps, and she shouts,
George, look what you've done now!
I burst out laughing.
Nicky!
She runs towards me, a smile broad and pale blue eyes twinkling. She wraps me in her love, and I cushion in. Grandad ambles over and ruffles my hair.
It's good to see you,
he says. He takes my hand and leads me to the kitchen. At the old formica table where I'd first learned to bake and where Grandad had fixed the puncture in my first red bicycle, I burst into tears. Grandad strokes my hand and Granny puts the kettle on.
Now, lass, I hope you're not crying over a man.
I liked him, Grandad.
If he's done you wrong, you can't like him now, hen.
But I can't just switch it off. Emotions aren't like that.
He lifts his thumb to his face and rubs his chin. He doesn't air his opinions much. He leaves all that to Granny. But when he does, it takes him some time to think first. Granny brings over a cold can of Coke and a glass with some ice. Just how I love it.
Granny, how did you know I was coming? Young Grandad don't drink Coke. She unfurls a tissue from under the cuff of her cardigan and dries my tears.
I always have a can of Coke in the fridge for you, just in case. I never let anyone touch it. I tell them you better not touch Nikki's Coke or I'll kick your ass.
We all laugh, and she sets down a plate of chocolate digestives. Grandad reaches for two, then hands one to Granny.
As I see it, loving someone is always a choice, Nikki. Do you think I'd still be here loving this old battle axe if it weren't a choice?
What do you mean, Grandad?
Every night we go to bed, and I choose to kiss her goodnight and tell her that I love her. And then, every morning I wake up and choose to love her again. Sure, we've had ups and downs. Every couple does. Those that don't are liars or hiding the truth. The world can be a harsh place. Lots of things that happen in life can knock you down and take your breath away. You need someone beside you that can bring light. Not just on the days when everything is good, but when that darkness comes too. Your granny, she's my sunlight, always has been. So if I can choose to love, you can choose the opposite. It just depends on whether he brings sunlight that makes you shine in his company or darkness that makes you vanish. If there's more darkness than light, then you must choose not to love and walk away. Never let anyone fade your light.
Granny bats a dishcloth playfully at him.
You and your poetic words, George, you silly old bat. I choose you to go and pick up those potatoes that are still lying on the ground.
I smile, but there's something in what Grandad is saying. Does Geo bring more darkness than light? At this moment, it's a total eclipse. He's broken my heart, and I'll never trust him again.
There's plenty of fish in the sea, Nikki, but you've got to watch out for the sharks, Granny says.
My sister is hiding turnip under her mashed potatoes. I did the same at her age. At least Mum doesn't put it on my plate anymore. Except for peas, and she knows I hate them. She's standing at the sink doing dishes before we've even finished eating. I throw a couple of peas at her back, and she turns around to scold my sister. I laugh, and Mum winks. It's good to be home, but already I'm bored. The doorbell rings. Mum slams her cloth into the sink, then tuts as soapy water splashes out. Who the hell is that at this time of night? She hates visitors that arrive unannounced. The house must have a 24-hour deep clean first. A voice booms through the letterbox.
The Nikki, she live here.
I jump from a seat. Only one person speaks like that. How did he find me?
I'll go. I'll tell him to get lost.
Mum says, my sister, excited by the change in routine, throws mash all over the floor. The bell rings again.
Hello? Anybody alive in house?
He'll have the neighbours out on the street with popcorn soon, and Mum will go mad if she's the centre of gossip. Ever since Dad left, she's been a stickler for us walking proud and being a perfect family. It's okay, Mum. I'll go. And don't listen at the window. She scrunches up her nose.
As if I would.
I know she would. Geo smiles up from the bottom of the steps. He holds out his arms for me, and I take a step back. A suitcase and a large backpack sit beside him. Does he think he's moving in?
My bella Nikki, I can find you.
Why, Geo? I told you it's over.
It's not over, Nikki. I do very bad thing. I know this. But I'm not the bad man.
You ruined everything, Geo. You ruined our dreams.
But we make new dream, Nikki. You think we have no more the dream?
I'm not going to be making any kind of plans with him. Twice now he's ruined everything, and I'll never trust him. Tears fall from my eyes, and I hate him all over again. I try to close the door, but he runs up the steps and wedges his big foot in it.
Nikki, I love you. Listen to me. My brother, he has the restaurant in Sicily. Beautiful restaurant. It sells fish.
I hate bloody fish. And anyway, Gio is a big dark shark. Just the kind Granny warned me about.
He tell me, go Sicily. Go work there with him.
Go then, Gio. I don't know why you've come here to tell me your good news.
It is beautiful place, my town. The beach is cold and the sea very hot. I show you best place to swimming. The fish, Nikki, they be beside you. My brother, he give me his house. We have own place. You love it. Come with me.
I've never been abroad before. I've walked the sands in Blackpool, but I've never stepped foot in a foreign land. Excitement tingles within me, and I find it hard to stand still. But I can't go with a liar.
Nikki, my family will love you, and this is a big chance.
We had chances before. He spoiled them. Joe drops to his knees, places his hands together in prayer, and looks up at me with big brown eyes. Rain drizzles around him, and a part of me feels sorry for him, the part that loved him.
Say yes, my Bella, Nikki. I be the good man. If you give me a chance, come to see the sunlight in Sicily.
The lies, the gambling, the heartache. I should slam the door on his face. But then, the sun and sea, our own place, a new life far from the dark clouds and the promise of thunder. And just like Grandad told me to do, I make my choice.
Chapter 22. Mrs. Hawthorne, Edinburgh. Reluctant to say goodbye, we share a bottle of wine over the phone until dawn. Neither of us relishes the silent beds that shun our presence. That's when Charles says it. At first, it's mumbled, as though he's trying to disguise the significance of his words. But they linger between us, weighty with promise and fear. But the quiver in his voice can't mask his angst. In the quiet hours of your absence, I've been thinking about us and our future. About waking up together, walking Jack in the park, dancing around the garden. We could have a joyous life. Come live with me. Let's not wait any longer to start our happy ever after. I've longed for those words. Planted the seeds in his head as we pruned forget-me-nots in his back garden. And each time I went home, I'd nurtured those thoughts by ensuring my distance left a void, a space where he'd miss me. But now that the moment is here, can I do it? Live with a man again? Invest all my well-being in someone else? I've accepted the solitude of being on my own for so very long. It's okay. It was a silly idea. I'm just missing you. I quite understand if it's not something you wish to do. But he isn't all those men that have come before. This is gentle Charles of the cornflower blue eyes. This is my saviour. I can't let happy ever after elude me now. Not at these late years. And I adore him. Charles, I'd love to.
Oh, how wonderful. How simply delightful.
Jack barks in tune to his excitement. But,
yes?
If I give up my apartment, What security would I have? What if it doesn't work out? I'd have nowhere to live. Things do go wrong, Charles. The line goes silent, and my teeth tear at the jagged skin around my fingernails. His answer could change everything. Strip away the facade of his adept Prince Charming. Then we'll marry. If something goes wrong, you'll get half of everything. The house, the savings, the pension. You'll be set for life. A sob tears at my throat. How different from all those men before him. Men who'd raped my emotions and finances. Always hungry. Forever needing more to make them bigger, more important, until beside them I'd grown small and insignificant. Charles?
Yes. It's too soon. A ridiculous idea at our age. Perhaps you'd prefer a little nest egg instead.
What a kind, generous man. But I'm not after his money, just his love. A chance to start something fresh amongst all the death and darkness. I'd love to marry you, I say, and he whoops with joy. But Charles...
Yes?
He drawls out the word, making me giggle. The house. Well, it will never feel like mine. Can we decorate?
We'll do anything you want.
I stifle a shriek of delight. I can't wait to rid the place of Clarissa. The next day I meet my sisters for lunch in a local pub, excited to share the news. As usual, they're dolled up to the nines, gazes straying to younger women, assessing their clothes, their hairstyles. But they only truly compete with each other. It's always been that way. Obsessed with her weight, Judy prods some dreary salad around her plate.
But you've only known him 6 months.
Why can't she be happy for me?
And his wife has only been dead 9 months. Isn't it a bit soon?
Mary adds before stuffing a cheeseburger into her big mouth. She'll be on the treadmill for 2 hours later, working it off. I stab a chip with a fork and reply, "He's everything I've ever wanted in a man." They glance at each other and pat red serviettes against their tight lips. The waiter brings over drinks, and Judy grabs the Diet Coke from his hand, just in case it gets muddled in with the 2 full fat ones. Heaven forfend.
"You've said that about every other man too, you know. Maybe you should wait a while,"
she says. Mary laughs.
"True. And anyway, how can you be bothered at your age? Aren't you done with all that fairy tale crap?"
"Just because it didn't work out for you," I retort. I throw my cutlery down. It clatters to the busy table with a clang, and they look up, eyes wide, lips pursed, oblivious to any hurt they've hurled from their caustic tongues. Why is it that, even after all these years, we still play our same roles, still follow the same patterns? The pub is busy. So many people cramped together in such a small space, and the stench of roast beef makes the warm air heavier to breathe. I rise, push back my chair, and squeeze through the tight space to escape outside. The beer garden is packed tight with benches, all of them occupied, but I find a small wall and sit down. Of course, his wife has been dead only a few months, but that doesn't mean he doesn't love me. He's shown it in so many ways. I light a cigarette and inhale until calm has been restored. They haven't even met him yet, so how can they judge him? Charles is awkward in social settings. He'd wanted to wait. Judy appears and sidles up beside me. I shift over to make room.
What are you doing, Dafty? Come back in.
She places a few timid pats on my shoulder. She knows I can't stand that sort of thing. But this is her in peacemaker mode, and I have to concede. That is how we do things in our sisterly paint-by-numbers way. I'm okay. Was just getting a cig. I throw the butt to the ground, stand and stamp it out. She rubs her arms and shivers, although it isn't cold, and her face compresses in concern. A frown magnifies the deep crease between her brows. At 60, the Botox doesn't help anymore, and it's hard to see the little girl that once sat on my knee while I brushed her long blonde hair.
We're just worried about you, that's all. We don't want to see you hurt. You're a big sister.
I'm okay. She bends and picks up my cigarette end and throws it into the nearest bin. Everything neat and tidy. I follow her back to the table. Mary sits with her head to the side, smiling like I'm some unfortunate stray child. I want to slap her face. Instead, I smile back and she says,
"Did you watch that new drama on TV last night? It had what's-her-name that was in the film we watched last year. The redhead. She used to go out with that guy from EastEnders."
And just like that, we've moved on. Like so many previous conversations that might have blown us apart, the topic is now buried beneath celebrity news. We often speak about Mother and her surface conversations. We'd never been allowed to talk of feelings or emotions. Yet we never admit that with each other, we do exactly the same. The waiter arrives to collect our plates. He has slicked back hair and a ruby embedded in his nose. He's young, about 30. Of course, this doesn't stop Mary from flirting with him, even at twice his age. When he offers us dessert menus, Judy stands in his way.
No, we don't want dessert. We're all full up.
The waiter jumps back, startled. As she shuffles the menus back into his hands, she turns to us and says,
"You didn't want anything, did you?"
Mary replies,
"Didn't have much choice, Judy, did we?"
I laugh and grab my bag. Lunch is over. On the walk home, I fantasize about what kind of wedding we'll have, what color dress I'll wear. Not white, after the last disaster, but maybe a soft pastel. Should we have a reception? And if we do, where? I suppose Robert will be Charles's best man, but how will I decide between my sisters for best maid? Whomever I choose, the other will be offended. I throw my bag onto the kitchen counter, pop the kettle on, and grab my phone. I wait for Charles to answer the call, fidgeting with questions. "My sisters are delighted. They can't wait to meet you."
"Good."
Something isn't right. His breath is labored and he sounds like he's been crying. Has he changed his mind? What's wrong? Is Jack okay? Charles sobs and dread crawls down my spine. I light a cigarette and time stretches between us. Before he composes himself enough to speak, my cigarette is burnt down to the stub.
"I'm quite all right," he says. "Just felt a bit sorry for myself there."
"Why, Charles? What happened?"
"Oh, it's nothing for you to worry about. How was lunch?"
Charles has never been dismissive before. There certainly is something to fret about. I need to discover what. "Charles, you need to tell me what's happened. We can't marry with secrets between us. He inhales deeply, then sighs, as if it's his last breath.
You caught me at a bad moment. That's all. I thought you might like one of Clarissa's rings. She has some gorgeous emeralds, and you love those stones. They're no good to her anymore. But when I went looking, I found a letter in her jewellery box.
A letter? From whom?
From my wife.
His wife? Am I not to bear that title? I detest her. Even dead, she ruins everything. This was meant to be our day. Oh, I'm so sorry. That must have been hard for you. What was in the letter?
Nothing. Nothing at all. It was just a shock. She must have written it before she died and then left it there for me to find. But everything is tickety-boo.
We talk for a while about inconsequential things. It doesn't seem appropriate to bring up wedding plans anymore. Then we say our goodbyes, arranging to meet in the morning. But a pain drums in my head much longer. What's in the letter? I need to find it.
Chapter 23. Ronnie, Liverpool. Paris was wonderful. We took a sunset cruise along the Seine and strolled hand in hand through the twinkling lights of the left bank, just like a normal couple. And anyone would have said we were in love. I guess one of us is. We've been home 2 weeks, and there are still hints of that romance, but the edge has returned. The roses he bought me today are gorgeous and in full bloom, but my focus is on the thorns. What price do I need to pay for his love? Graham saunters into the bedroom, trying to disguise his excitement for the night with a casual stance.
So, what kind of boundaries and rules do you want, Ronnie?
I glance over at him, the question catching me off guard. I've not really thought about it, but we've only an hour left. I roll silk stockings up my legs and want to blurt out, it's off. We aren't doing it anymore. I want monogamy. I want Paris back. But that would chase him away. And it isn't his fault. He hasn't had a life like the rest of us. And he'd rather break up than hurt me with a cheater's lie. No kissing. No exchanging phone calls. And no emotional connections. I reply. He nods and splashes on some cologne. And through vanilla mist, he peels on some tight leather pants. What damn cliches we are. As we stand outside the sex club, a burly doorman demands identification. He's as intimidating as the secret world hidden within the red door behind him. My tummy spins, and I run my tongue along my dry lips. What the fuck am I doing? Graham hands over our passports, and after a nod, the door is opened, and we enter the main room. It's dark, with black painted walls and low dingy lighting. There's a bar in the corner, and a bunch of people are queuing up, waiting to be served. Music thumps out from two large speakers on a small empty dance floor. The atmosphere feels sticky, as if it will coat my skin. Couples are huddled together on sofas, while others are eyeing each other up, and one woman in her underwear is having a spin on a stripper pole. She's young, slim, and tanned. The air smells of popcorn, a trick the club's implemented to boost sales and conceal the smell of sex that'll soon swamp us. I tug on Graham's arm. I can't do it.
Shh. You're fine, he whispers.
He guides me over to the bar where we're meant to hand in our drinks. They don't have a license, but you bring your own. He asks the barman, who's dressed only in a tight lime thong, to pour us doubles. I clutch Graham's hand and clung to the thought that we might escape soon. As we descend stairs into an even dimmer set of rooms, I spot an empty four-poster bed with vibrators, floggers, and whips on display. Graham releases my hand and bounces on the mattress like a child.
Join me, Ronnie. Come on.
He springs up to grab me, but I step back, evading his grasp.
No way, Graham. Imagine all the diseases on those sheets. Oh, you're no fun.
I give him the finger, finish my drink, and turn away. I'm overdressed in my miniskirt and strappy vest, yet I'd worried at home it was over the top. I'm going to need more vodka to get through this night. We walk into a seedy cinema showing hard porn. I'd laugh at the fake moans coming from the screen if it weren't for the number of guys sitting in the chairs with their dicks out, panting along. In the front row, a woman being fucked from behind is giving another guy a blowjob. She's having fun. And I clamp down the urge to march up and throw them off. We move to a red room, where a bunch of men stand naked, pressed tight against a wooden wall divider. I'm not sure what's going on, but I can't take my eyes off their bare asses. Some are firm and tight, whereas others jiggle like jelly, dimpled and round.
It's a glory hole, Graham says. Look at the other side.
That'll be right. I turn to leave, feeling my way out with my palms. A stranger's hand creeps up my skirt. I recoil back in fright.
No thanks,
Graham says politely, as if he's in the Savoy. The guy shrugs and shuffles away, and my skin crawls at the ghost of his damp touch. A clump of bodies are fucking each other in the corridor, and we have to squeeze past them to get to the next room. It's cramped, bodies writhing on a black rubber floor. I fidget and fiddle with the empty glass in my hand, not knowing what to do. Graham edges closer to the action, his eyes almost on stalks. I laugh. He's like the roadrunner hanging suspended in mid-air. Meep, meep, I say, just for shits. Graham's brows furrow, and he squints at me like I've gone mad. Maybe I have. Go on, join in. You're dying too. I let go of his hand and push him forward. He doesn't need any more encouragement than that, and I sprint from the sleaze and head for the bar. Treble vodka, lemonade and ice, please. The bartender has matched his thong with a string vest, and his nipple rings poke through the holes in the thread. I should tell him, just in case they catch on to something. But then, maybe that's the point.
Ronnie, is that you?
My fingers grip the edge of the bar. Who's that? One of the kids' dads from school? Or even worse, a school governor? I can't reply and out myself. Why the hell did I come here? The barman passes over my drink and I gulp some of it down. Look for somewhere to hide.
Ronnie?
Oh my God! Why doesn't he fuck off? A trio dressed in latex catsuits slides up beside me and leans on the bar. I slip through them and escape. I need to get Graham and get the fuck out of this place. I don't give a shit if he's in the middle of some bitch. I march back to the rubber room, head down, hair drawn over my face. A hand on my elbow jerks me to a stop.
Ronnie, it's me, Tom.
Tom? I glance up. I've seen him before, but not at school. It's the guy from the swapping night, the family lawyer. I should have guessed he'd show up here. Well, well. Where's Kirsty? I ask, edging myself against a wall, trying to be small, the panic still not fully gone. He grins.
It's single men's night. She's not here. I told you. She's just a friend anyway.
I nod and slosh the ice around in my glass, contemplating my next move. Should I ignore him or stop and chat? A woman dressed in leather chaps struts past. Crawling behind her is an overweight bald guy. A furry tail protrudes from his arse, and once in a while, he stops to wiggle and wag it. She tugs on his leash to hurry him along.
So, I take it you didn't come here for the ambience,
he says with a wink. I meet Tom's eyes, and we erupt into laughter. It cuts the tension, and something between us catches and sparks. I've not noticed how his smile lights up his face before. No, Tom, it's not quite my idea of elegance. Our eyes crinkle in mirth, and my panic settles. He's an ordinary guy. There's a velvet sofa to the left of us hidden in a corner. It's fairly clean and free of stains, so I smooth down my skirt to cover my thighs and sit. He joins me, but ensures there's a respectful distance between our bodies. I like that.
So, where's Graham then?
He asks. Oh, he's in that big room with all the rubber padding. God knows what he's doing. I shudder to signify it's not my kind of thing.
I don't think God will be that interested. Do you?
He's funny. I like that too. A woman in a maid's outfit jumps onto a guy's lap. The place is so busy that some of the soft action has slipped into the lounge. But here, in the corner, it's fine. My hands wrap around my glass. If you ignored the setting, I could be like a mother waiting for her child to run off some energy on a visit to soft play. Graham will be back soon, asking for a drink and a snack, all puffed out. So why are you here, Tom, if not for Kirsty? He glances over at the moons coming from a corner, then turns his attention back to me.
I'm so busy at work, there's never enough time for anything else. But, well, a man has needs, you know. And this is the easiest way. No strings, no pressures. And then I go back to my desk.
But don't you want more than just sex?
Yeah, of course I do. I'd love to have the white picket fence and all that. But where do you meet someone to devote your life to? At a nightclub where everyone's drunk? It's not like the old days. And with the hours I put in at work, it's never the time.
Yeah, I get what you mean. I tried it too. All those single nights, and then running home, full of shame, to eat a meal for one, not two. He edges closer, brushes his fingers along my arm, and looks into my eyes.
Unless it was someone like you,
he whispers.
I'd make sure I had time then.
Giggling like a silly teenager, I pull my arm away and place it by my side where it's safe. I'm not sure how to react. Is he just playing a game? Are these just lines? Or am I really that special to him? He leans in closer and traces a finger gently down my face. His breath sends a shiver of desire.
I've thought about doing this since I met you, Ronnie.
He lowers his mouth to mine, and I'll lose myself in the tenderness of his kiss. Hands grab Tom's shoulders, and he's torn off me and tossed to the floor. Graham stands in the empty space, glaring down at him.
What the hell you doing, mate?
I'm frozen to the sofa. I've never seen Graham angry before. He's usually devoid of any type of emotion unless, of course, he wants something. He hunches his shoulder and cocks a fist, glowering at Tom, who lifts his hands in defeat and shrugs. Then he stands and slowly brushes the dust from his clothes. Ignoring Graham, he turns to me.
Think about it, Ronnie. I'll wait as long as it takes.
And with that, he strides away like prey teasing the hunter to come seize it. I'm not sure if he means the hunter to be Graham or me.
What's that dick saying? Wait for what, Ronnie?
Graham says, fists still clenched. Nothing. He talks rubbish. But I'm secretly pleased. Tom's got balls, and he clearly likes me. Maybe I like him too. Graham grabs my hand.
You've had too much to drink. Let's go home.
Too much to drink? He's never complained before. Then I get it. He's jealous. That's why he's so angry. Oh, have I spoiled his night? Snare him has a new weapon. It's Tom.